Thank you. So I would normally start with some kind of apology. I don't have to invent one this time. I flew in recently, and I'm not quite fully aware of the date and the time or anything. Okay. Now I think you can function surprisingly well without really knowing these things. But okay. So but I think that'll explain any problems. I mean, the other thing is, I would normally speak for a few minutes. If I'm speaking in continental Europe and English is a second language, I normally just waste time for a few minutes just to get used to the accent. I don't know if I have to do that here. I spoke to some Australians and they assured me that the Scottish accent goes down quite well in New Zealand. Yeah. Okay, so that is a good enough response.
That's where we get our universities from.
Okay, so I didn't like to assume. Okay. Oh no. Okay. I was. I don't suppose you watch. You get sort of BBC programs. There's a. Oh, no response to that one. Okay. Yeah. So there's a TV program called Bodyguard that just out, and it's got this guy protecting the Home Secretary, and he's got this horrendous Scottish accent. It's kind of robotic, and it's all, you know, and it's all about, the whole plot is about how he has to take detours in London to keep her safe. So it's all, you know, we'll take the ring road, ma'am, you know, that sort of thing. So it almost put me off this program. Then when I gave a talk a couple of weeks ago, someone from Denmark said, you know, this guy sounds like David Budd from The Bodyguard. You know, so I've never been so insulted in my entire life. This guy's from Renfrewshire. Okay, so. Right, so that'll do it. So if you remember one thing, is I do not sound like David Budd. Okay, so I'm trying to be really too clever in this talk. So I've given quite a lot of talks over the past couple of years to scientists. Oh, in fact, I'm going to get rid of that. Right, I'm just going to mind. To scientist audiences who don't have a background in politics or public policy, and I'm thinking, how do you explain the policy process and the role of evidence within it to people who haven't read any of the literature, and to be honest, well, never will. You have no interest in policy theory, but might have an interest in some of the insights if you can translate them. So that's the sort of thing I've been doing for the past couple of years. So I've been trying to be clever here in trying to talk about what I would talk about in these talks, rather than just talking about the talk. Right, so it's kind of high bar stuff, isn't it? It's two levels. So I'm going to describe what I say to them, to you, so that we can talk about how to describe things to other disciplines. You know, so, okay. So, I needed to preface it like that because sometimes I'll give, like I gave a talk on something like this at Southampton, and Rod Rhodes was in the room. Did you know? Right. Okay. So he said. He said at the end, so thanks for your story and all that. But then he said. I'm paraphrasing, but he said, don't you know that lots of people have different knowledge claims, right? So I had to ask myself why he would ask me that if I knew that already, right? And it's because I got so used to speaking with an audience where they don't think that, they think there's one knowledge claim, you know, it's scientific evidence, right? Okay, so I don't want you to judge me thinking I'm a kind of naive scientist. Okay, so these are the three things that I would always talk about to explain to that kind of audience why policymakers seem to ignore your evidence. Okay, so the first is that there are lots of ways of defining evidence and good evidence. And so what really a lot of audiences are thinking, why do they ignore this particular form of scientific evidence, which is at the top of our hierarchy of knowledge? Okay, so why would they ignore, for example, you know, the kind of the tip-top randomized controlled trial evidence? And pay attention to this other nonsense. You know, I think that's what lots of scientists are thinking. Why are they not paying attention to the good evidence? And you know, they're paying attention to anything they can find. So often, in that kind of context, scientists will describe the idea that policymakers are cherry picking evidence that they like, rather than engaging in a sort of wider discussion about you know, various forms of evidence that could be seen as legitimate. You know, so that's, I mean, I would kind of, if you imagine talking to this audience, I'll just say that and no more. But you could spend the rest of the hour talking about, you know, what is good evidence and how you assess knowledge claims and that sort of thing. Okay, but we don't have too much time for that. So the second one would be about information processing. So a lot of that's to do with the psychology of choice and the shortcuts, you know, the individual shortcuts that people use to gather enough, process enough information to make choices. And to do that, I think usually would say, often people or scientists talk about an evidence gap that they have to fill, when it's more useful to talk about an excess amount of evidence and the need to ignore most of it. You know, so I think in policy studies, you would get used to talking about the difference between comprehensive rationality and bounded rationality. You know, people have to use shortcuts to gather enough evidence. And if I'm feeling provocative for that audience, I would say, you know, there's a sort of distinction you can make between rational and irrational forms of evidence gathering. And so you would say, you know, scientists think that they are the rational ones, and they think that policymakers, they are the irrational ones. And that's what explains the process. But instead, you would talk about, you know, all individuals combine cognition and emotion to make choices. So we just have to understand the particular ways in which particular people combine those things to make choices. And I think that explains a lot of sort of researcher angst about ignoring evidence, you know, because people have to ignore almost everything to make choices. And I think that's sort of summed up in there's this phrase that I've kind of paraphrased from Frank Baumgartner, who talks about punctuated equilibrium theory, and it's along the lines of almost everyone ignores almost everything almost all of the time. You know, that's really punctuated equilibrium summed up in a nutshell. And you know, so you can't expect anything different. And then the third thing would be about complexity. So I think you would talk about that distinction between a policy cycle and a more complicated model of the policy process. So you would say, you know, lots of people, when they venture into policy studies, the first thing they'll find, or the first thing they'll see, is a sort of cyclical diagram where the policy process is broken down into stages. And you can tell where to present evidence at each stage. You know, so evidence is there to help you identify the nature of the problem at the agenda setting stage. It helps you identify evidence-informed solutions at the formulation stage. And then it helps you provide evidence to evaluate policy that feeds into the next cycle. And so I would normally say, you know, the policy process is much more complicated than this, and I tend to only talk about the policy cycle when I'm describing what doesn't happen. You know, that's the kind of classic ideal type kind of discussion. So that's usually how you would start any of these things. And then you can kind of branch off into lots of discussions about the implications. So that is, in a nutshell, I don't know if you can tell this, but the interesting thing here for me, apart from, and normally if I'm trying to waste some time, I would say, do you know what this top right image is? And I am, that's what I'm doing right now. Do anyone know what that is?
It's a power, like a thing like something on the streets. Like,
yeah.
What kind of linking power to houses and buildings?
Yeah, and I think it's in Thailand. So I forget now what I searched for, right? But I found it. I mean, this is the perfect image, really, because it's sort of, instead of thinking of one cycle, you're thinking, well, the policy process is made up of a huge collection of cycles that somehow interact with each other within a system that produces something. And I think the reason I like this image so much is because it still works. You know, the electricity system still works. It looks horrendously dangerous, and you wouldn't want to get anywhere near it, but, you know, it still does the job. You know, and I think that's how you could sum up the policy process. So that compares with the simpler cycle that I described. And the interesting thing for me is, what I used to say about the cycle was, people might accept that it doesn't exist, but governments still project this cycle image because it really fits in with one or two models of how policy should be made, and it fits in really well with things like the Westminster system, because essentially you can point to the cycle and say, this is how we turn our manifesto into policy or something like that. You know, we've identified our aims and we use this cycle to smooth out the process. But increasingly governments would not use this language. apart from a few people who held out, or a few governments that held out, and one of the biggest ones used to be the European Commission. You know, the sort of European Commission story is that because they weren't directly elected, they have to find other means to legitimise their activities. And one was, you know, a highly evidence-based system with a really clear process. So the interesting thing for me is that this is now what the European Commission puts up to describe their activities. You've got time, you know, look, you can follow the lines, you know, follow the squiggles, and they don't really go anywhere. So I did meet the person who drew it, and it is supposed to project mess. You know, it's not actually it doesn't perform any other function than this one. Just to say, the policy process is really messy. And in fact, if you go to I went to a lot of these kind of evidence and policy talks, and there was always someone from the Commission would come along and put this up and say, look, we used to talk about this, now we talk about this. Okay, so I think even governments are now projecting a sense of mess rather than projecting a sense of order. Okay, so this is how I like to portray it. Now, I should be honest, I did this because, I don't know, if you use Twitter a lot, often people will tweet pictures of workshops and conferences. You know, take pictures and share them, okay? And I thought it's often the pictures that people share. So I thought, I've got to have a picture. You know, I need to want to share that. Okay. So I came up with this. You can just mock these up in Microsoft Word. And so it's supposed to be, in the middle is some kind of notion of policy choice. You know, and I sort of regret, I put rational and irrational. So as I said, I put that up just to annoy some scientists in the audience, right? But it's going to backfire because sometimes people will come up to me and say, oh, you know, this distinction is really simplistic. You know, okay, but fair enough. But you were talking about rational, irrational choice in the middle, surrounded by a policy-making environment. Now, so I would call it an environment rather than a system. If we've got time to talk about the distinctions, let's do that. But I think, as you'll see, the environment that I've described really maps on well to some easy-looking advice about how to engage in the policy system. Whereas the system metaphor doesn't. This is, we can talk about this, but I think this kind of system analogy, it really just encourages you to give up. You know, life's too complicated. Things just emerge, and no one controls it. Right. Whereas this one actually gives you hope. Look at it. Look how ordered and simple it seems. Okay, so you've got, so normally I would just put this up for a second and say to people, in fact I do this with students as well, I say if you can understand the concepts in this picture, you understand the policy process and the literature. So you say, okay, the environment is made up of five or six things. Okay, so we know that instead of there being one single central government decision maker in charge of all things, you have many policymakers and influencers spread across many levels and types of government. And so that would be summed up in literatures like multi-level governance or polycentric governance and sorts of like. And then you have, let's see, what number order? If you go clockwise, I'm getting confused because, right, so if you go, is that clockwise? If you go clockwise, the next is institutions.
I was going to say my equal.
What's that?
I go clockwise.
Right, okay. Wait, well, is that clockwise? Hang on, that's clockwise, right? So.
Water guys.
Okay, so it's just right, but it's like that photo thing. That's clockwise to me, but that must be
from your perspective.
Right. So we go that way. We go institutions, and you would say, okay, so the take-home point from institutional literature is that there are regular patterns of behaviour and policy making influenced by rules and norms within particular organisations. Many of them are sort of formal and written down. You can understand them quite easily, but most of them are informal, unwritten, and they're often communicated non-verbally. So you would say to people, you know, you've got to understand the rules of policymaking systems to understand how to engage within them. Okay, and so on. So if you get the idea, I don't want to repeat. Let me see. Yeah, so if you imagine, these concepts map on to simple-looking advice for people trying to engage more effectively with evidence in the policy process. So with the multi-level governance point, you know, you would say find out where the action is. Well, is this cut off? But, you know, find out who you should speak to rather than assuming that they're in, you know, they're a minister in central government, something like that. Learn the rules within particular policy-making venues. And that will take some time because some of the rules are hard to pick up. Now, I don't know. I honestly have no conception of time, so I don't know how much of it I can waste of your time while I'm talking about this. But I would normally ask for an example of rules. Let's see, this is good. If you're teaching this stuff, I think this is good for students. Because you say, you know, students, what are the rules of the university that are not written down? Don't know, anyone willing to give me an unwritten rule of the university? Please.
Consultation is a fraud.
Okay. It's just, are we tapping into the internal politics?
Don't annoy your marker.
What's that?
Don't annoy your marker.
Okay, right, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, okay, so, but I guess, so, now I think the difference between those two things might be everyone sort of knows that one, whereas the university might project the sense that consultation is a good thing, they take it seriously. So that's the importance of an informal unwritten rule, isn't it? Often they contradict the formal written rules. The one I like with students, the minister's really kind of a bit too meta, is I say to students, the unwritten rule is you must never answer a question your lecturer asks you in this kind of environment, you know. And they don't get, as far as I know, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it happened, but they don't get together outside the theatre and say, like, let's not answer this question. Just stay quiet, you know. But somehow they communicate this to each other that they should just kind of look at their feet and just wait it out. You know, it's the big game between the lecturer and the student. Just wait, he'll move on. You know, so that's the kind of unwritten, somehow communicated rules. Okay, so imagine saying to people, presenting evidence to government organisations, learn the rules. Well, it sounds so simple, but, you know, it'll take you a lifetime to work out these unwritten things. Where often you can really annoy people and put them off your evidence just by breaking the rules somehow. But you wouldn't know what they were. Okay. So, what's the next one? So, this doesn't go clockwise, I'm afraid. I've failed you with my PowerPoint here. So, learn the language would be ideas. Ideas. So that would be, you know, we talk about ideas as two things. So often you talk about ideas as paradigms. You know, it's a kind of language used or a series of assumptions that underpin you know, policymaking that are often taken for granted, but not particularly expressed. So I think the classic would be, you know, the Peter Hall's discussion of paradigms in economic policy. So during the Keynesian times, you know, people just assumed that there was one economic paradigm. I did economics as a degree, but it's all kind of getting away from me. But you would say, okay, so they never really talked about the fundamental things they were doing. All they would talk about is the changes to the instruments. You know, first and second order change would be about, you know, adjusting interest rates or adjusting, you know, capital spending without having this big discussion between each other. But you could tell, you know, if you observed it from the outside, you could tell what the kind of language represented in a much more fundamental sense. So I think in more modern arenas, you might say, well, sometimes the language is about hierarchies of evidence. So often in public health or medical science, you would say the language is very much in terms of establishing your credentials through evidence. But in other fields, like, I don't know, say treasury fields, the language is much more around, you know, things like value for money. And, you know, there's a certain way of talking that corresponds to sort of the beliefs that people have within these venues that are, again, hard to pick up. But if you immerse yourself in these venues, you can learn that language and learn how to operate. Okay, the next one, networks. I would say, so when I was a student, we ever really studied was networks, and the idea was that it was a kind of bounded rationality point again, that ministers may ostensibly in charge of their departments, but they can only pay attention to a tiny proportion of their responsibilities. So they have to delegate almost all of the things they're responsible for to civil servants at a relatively low level. Those civil servants often are generalists rather than specialists, so they rely on outside interests for expertise and advice. And if those people providing the information become reliable, then they can form these is networks or communities with policymakers. So a piece of advice from that would be, you know, engage in these networks to build up trust and or form alliances with people. And so if I'm feeling energetic, I would say there are three sort of ways in which people might form these kind of coalitions. You know, one is you've worked together in the past and proved reliable. The other is you share the same beliefs about policy, and the other is someone has some kind of authority figure. You know, so you could take those kind of general insights and work out how to build trust within policymaking. And the more you're trusted, the more people will listen to your evidence. And then finally, probably the trickiest one, is this idea that you know, lots of policy is driven by events or changes in socioeconomic conditions. So find the right times to exploit changes in those conditions that prompt disproportionate bursts of attention in policymakers. Okay, so that's the closest thing I would get to kind of, you know, being a consultant saying, here's my five tips for policy engagement. But if you look at them, they're all sort of impossible tasks. I was trying to find, I don't know, this never really works, but I've not found a better one. You know, the labors of Hercules. You know this story where, it's nothing like I only saw the Disney version, and I was quite surprised at how this all worked out, but essentially he has to atone for his sins through these impossible tasks, and I think that's what we're describing with these. You know, the idea that you could actually effectively do this, you know, forge a scientific career, research career, and then also spend all that time doing these things, it's almost impossible. You know, so I think there are trade-offs to be talked about. But imagine, the key one, I think, would be how you can spend enough time immersing yourself in government departments to learn the language and the rules is beyond me without, working there. So, I mean, normally I would say, you know, here are the tips. But I think with different audience, you would say, you know, these things actually expose the complexities of policymaking and the necessary limits to the use of evidence or the direct provision of evidence by researchers, given that these are impossible tasks. Okay, so sometimes I would just stop there, you know, because I'm satisfied with that. You know, I think if you're an academic, you think, oh, your life is complicated. Yeah, let's go home. You know, that's the usual. That's where you normally stop. But then it would kind of explore these, what you might do about it. It's 4:30. I don't know, how long do people normally talk before?
It'd be good if you were done by, say, 1:45.
Okay, so I can nick through.
Assuming you want questions from the floor.
Yeah, sure. Let's say that. Yeah, So we're now into the kind of variants of these talks. So this one, I think, seemed useful for this audience because if you're not familiar with these theories, I'm sure they're very interesting. I'm relying on being interesting. But if you are, I guess you could listen to the way I describe them really quickly to see the shortcuts I'm using to give advice. And there are phenomenal shortcuts. I mean, I think, I sometimes use this phrase, you know, I've read this literature, so you don't have to. And I think that is the case for most of my audience. You know, they will never read this stuff. They haven't read it. So they're relying on me entirely to give them the messages from it. Okay, so I can do what I like in a sense. But if you know more about it, then you can tell me if this is wrong. Okay, so the first one would be, you know, increasingly important is the narrative policy framework, and it says you can explain the success of particular policy frames or stories with reference to four elements of a story. If I can remember, that would be the setting, the characters, the moral. Oh, now I've missed one. I shouldn't have said four. anyone tell me what the setting, character?
Is it a challenge or a hardship? Where you found Joseph Campbell's
plot. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So setting, characters, plot, moral. Okay, so they say you can break down policy stories into these four categories and try and measure the effectiveness of particular ones. Now, I mean, that's an interesting one for me because from what I can tell of the literature they publish on, you know, experiments and the more evidence side of things, they do find these differences in the impact of different stories on different people. So, for example, there's a kind of good climate change paper that they've got about which story on climate change works. But my impression from the stuff they've produced is the biggest impact is of a story to an audience that already believes the thing you're telling them. So it reinforces what they're doing. And it's not to change their minds, it's to reinforce their minds enough to make them act somehow. You know, so the thing I would take from, you know, the tell good stories framework is tell good stories to people you know already agree with you, because they're the only ones you're going to motivate to do something. Okay. Now, there's a whole bunch of stuff that people have written that go into that in more depth. And maybe that's the wrong message, but that's certainly, I think actually, you know, Mike Jones and colleagues say something different. They're more ambitious about the impact of stories, but okay. But I don't believe it, so they haven't convinced me. Okay, so the second one would be multiple streams. And this is all about the practical advice is, you know, be entrepreneurial, exploit windows of opportunity. And I think that phrase has some traction in lots of the audience. I think lots of people in my usual audience have already used that phrase, window of opportunity, and they think that is the key thing within policymaking. Now, I think the thing for me about that is I think what people have in their minds is a window of opportunity to influence an individual. So imagine, okay, so... right. So imagine someone has sent you an email by mistake, and they've said something insulting about you. I don't know if you've had any of these kind of emails by mistake. And then you get another email from the person saying, "Oh, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to send you that. Oh, very apologetic." Now that is a window of opportunity to get something you want from them, right? Because they're so apologetic. Right. I'll do anything for you just to get out of the awkwardness. Okay. Now, I think that's what people have in mind when they think of a window of opportunity. Whereas Kingdon is actually talking about a political system style opportunity which can take maybe 20 years to happen. Now, I think that's a real difference from waiting for the right time to respond to someone's email to get what you want, to waiting 20 years for the right conditions to appear. Now, I think, I don't know, if we had more time, I would go into the what I think is the correct analogy for that, and it's the space launch. It's not this water nonsense. You know, if you study multiple streams, don't be fooled by all that watery metaphors. It's the space launch. Because you imagine he's talking about three things have to happen at the same time for this window to appear. Policymaker attention rises to a particular way to understand a problem. There is a technically and politically feasible solution available to be attached to that problem. And policymakers have the motive and opportunity to adopt that solution. And so that can take decades within a policymaking environment that's more or less conducive to those things. So I think, his analogy was often, you know, that they're, you know, entrepreneurs are surfers on the wave, to give the impression that the environment is much more important than the person. I don't know, I don't really go surfing, but that, you know, so that would be, you'd rely on, I'm guessing, the water, not that much, the water and the waves, and without those, you can't really, you know, if it was, there must be a technical answer to this, but you know, if there's a really kind of flat water, there's no surfing going on. I think that's what he's getting at, isn't he? There's surfers, and they're very skilled and all, but they're entirely dependent on their environment for anything to happen. You know, I think the spaceship metaphor works because essentially some of this is about some control over choices. You know, they can choose to launch or not. But most of the explanatory work for a space launch comes from the weather, isn't it? It's the environmental conditions determine whether or not someone can take off. Okay. So, and you can't really do anything about the weather. I think that's the point. You know, it suggests being entrepreneurial is something that you're in charge of. You know, you can invest and reap rewards from. I think, you know, these are environmental explanations. The next one is, if you notice, I don't know if you know this, if you put up a slide with words on it, people read the words and they stop listening to you. So I started covering up the words just to I refuse to give you the words to distract you with. But this is the Advocacy Coalition Framework Flow Diagram. And don't waste your time trying to read the words. There's no time to get into it. So it's just there to demonstrate, I think, often what they get at is this idea that, that people get into politics to turn their beliefs into policy. They form coalitions with people who share their beliefs, and they compete with coalitions who don't. And sometimes they talk about this idea that people within these coalitions romanticise their own cause, and they demonise their opponents. Now, I think if you were thinking about strategies for engagement in politics, again, that would very much suggest that there'll be very little point in presenting evidence to coalitions who have a fundamental opposition to the thing you're telling them. Much better to become a member of the coalition that basically agrees with your information and advice, and then act in concert with that coalition of people to turn your beliefs into policy. Now, I should say, some of the other ACF work talks about scientists and researchers being brokers if the issues are low salience. So I think you've got a distinction there. In high salience competitive issues, you should just work with coalitions who romanticise your evidence. If it's low salience, there's some role for researchers to be brokers. Okay. Oh, right, there's only two more theories. It's like in a tour through, if you imagine, if you're teaching this on a master's, this is a year's worth of theories we're going through. But you've only got 30 minutes for someone to go through them all. If we're being honest, by now people have stopped listening to it, we're just going to, we're swimming here. But this would be punctuated equilibrium theory. And I think if you had to sum that up in a nutshell, you would say that the policy process produces a huge number of small policy changes and a small number of huge policy changes. And the explanation for that tends to be levels of attention. So policymakers can only pay attention to a tiny proportion of the issues that are out there. So when they pay disproportionately high attention, that can produce major policy change. But the logical consequence is that they have to pay almost no attention to everything else, and that contributes to minimal policy change. So I think that really maps on to simple advice. One is, now actually this is an interesting one. I think the people I speak to, their instinct is to think, how can I be the exception to produce attention to this tiny proportion of issues? How do I frame an issue to get that attention? I mean, that's one thing you can talk about, but I think there's better value in doing the other thing, which is framing issues as technical and only there for the researchers so that you can limit attention and keep it low. I think if I was looking for an easier life, I would think, there's nothing better than just framing something as humdrum so that you've got a very restricted audience. If people only pay attention to a tiny proportion of issues, why not present something, evidence, to an audience, a very specialist audience, in the hope that no one else will ever pay attention to it. That's a kind of, it's maybe not the most democratic thing, right? But it's the most pragmatic. And I think those are the choices you've got, isn't it? If your main aim is to get your evidence into policy, why would you want lots of people paying attention to it when you know that high salience issues causes all sorts of competition over how to present evidence? Why not just go for the, keep it quiet? Okay, I'm just going through. I forgot to say, I'm normally presenting these as a kind of ladder of ethical dilemmas. So we're up there. We're quite high now in ethical dilemmas. But I think, in public people say, oh no, this is all about, we've got to deliberate and talk about these things. But secretly people think, oh yeah, right. Minimise attention. That's the one to go for. So the next one is at the top of the ethical ladder, I guess. So there's a large literature on social construction and policy design, and most of it's from the US, but it has applications outside. And essentially, they describe our policy process as dysfunctional, or degenerate. I think the phrase is degenerative. And they say, this is how policymakers do it. They exploit social stereotypes to characterise some populations as worthy of government benefits and some populations as worthy of punishments. They cherry-pick research evidence to back up those characterisations. They reward and punish those populations, and it has this huge sort of feedback effect, or feed-forward effect on populations. The populations that are hard done by see no incentive to engage in politics, so it alienates particular populations. The populations who benefit from government rewards see far higher reasons to engage in politics. So it reinforces this kind of distinction between deserving and undeserving. Okay. Or they talk about this the alternative as a kind of low salience issues, which is largely done by bureaucrats and researchers. In each case, it kind of alienates or excludes most citizens from deliberation. So, if I'm feeling energetic, I'll do this. Try and do this one with a straight face. You know, I would say, you know, this is up with your the top of your ethical dilemmas. But you can, I think, researchers have got this choice between challenging governments when they stereotype populations, because that's, you know, the good ethical thing to do. Or, exploiting those stereotypes as the best way of getting your evidence into policy. So if you're dealing with a minister who has a very kind of particular view on populations, the best way to influence them with evidence is to, you know, to feed into those biases. Okay. Now, I think the only thing about this in terms of giving advice is it's unclear often what they are talking about at that key stage. Now, sometimes they talk about policymakers strategically using these stereotypes. So they know that people in the wider population have these ideas about populations, and they exploit them for electoral gain, even if they don't hold those beliefs themselves. Or they draw on their own emotions to make quick and easy decisions about populations. It's not clear in the literature which one they're talking about. And that really matters. You know, if they're being strategic, then you have particular choices about how you feed into their activities. If they're actually making these emotional choices, I think the only way to influence them is to feed those choices. I don't think unless you're more skilled than I've seen anyone. I don't see researchers being able to produce good research and fundamentally change the opinion of policymakers when they've made these emotional choices. So, make of that what you will, but I mean, I think that is, you know, so these are the worst choices to make. You know, should you challenge or feed into these biases that policymakers have? And I guess most people would choose the challenging one in this room, okay, but probably means they'll have no influence on policymaking whatsoever. And so, you know, that's the starkest of choices, I think. You know, do you want to be ethical and uninfluential? Or unethical and really influential? Okay, so I can't answer that one for you. Okay, so if you sum up in a few sentences, this is the sort of advice you would give to people in that context. You know, find ethical ways to exploit the ways in which people make choices. Tell a story, because evidence won't speak for itself. You're trying to get attention for your issue at the expense of others. You know, something of punctuated equilibrium. Only so many choices get attention. Be flexible, because one strategy will really work intensely well in one venue, but will fall flat in another. You know, so you would engage in trial and error. Engage in coalitions and be entrepreneurial. You know, all that sort of thing. And normally that's, you know, you've just finished there and you get a nice polite round of applause before the real speaker comes on. You know, I'm normally the warm-up act for the real one. So these are the things you miss out, I think. The first one would be, sort of, I think if you're thinking in terms of political systems, it doesn't make sense to talk about being entrepreneurial, because it's the systemic effects are the things that are determining what's going on. And that's I don't say that too much, because that's a really dispiriting conclusion, isn't it? You know, your role as an individual is minimal. You're one speck of, you're one grain of sand on a beach. No one wants to hear that in an inspirational speaker slot. Okay. The second one as well is, when we're talking about impact, the opportunities to do it and the rewards are shared unequally. Okay, so, I don't know, for example, in the UK, if you look at the sort of case studies we now produce for, you know, to demonstrate impact at universities, I think it's something like, at least in my field, 2/3 of these case studies were of these heroic male professors, white male professors, you know, charging in and having an impact with evidence when no one else could do it. Okay, and that would reflect the sense that, you know, the rewards for engaging impact are shared unequally. And actually, the penalties for engaging are shared unequally as well. Okay, so I don't, I've only been abused verbally on social media once in my whole career. And I know that's not, you know, that wouldn't be the norm. Okay. And there'd be few incentives, I do sometimes say this, there'd be few incentives to develop these skills, I think, if you wanted a life outside of your work. Because I reckon I've just described two jobs. You know, one job is the researcher and one job is the knowledge broker. Okay, so, I don't know, some people would like the idea, I guess you like the challenge. Some people would think, okay, well, I want some kind of normal work in life, so you have to make choices, and I think it's a legitimate choice to say, I choose not to have impact because there's not enough time, not enough hours in the day. Okay. Okay, that's a terrible way to end it. Okay, thank you.